Greetings. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. We continue our series on faith in the new atheism. Myself and Father Justin Gable giving lectures every Tuesday evening. And in today's installment, diving into the very famous five ways of St. Thomas Aquinas, looking at we might articulate God's existence, not simply from a theological perspective of faith, but from creation itself, looking at the observable nature and arguing backwards from the effects to a kind of cause. And so God's existence as the cause of all causes, as the unmoved mover, as a source of all life, existence itself is preeminent in our minds. Then we look at some other arguments, Newman's illative sense, looking at conscience and moral life, and then also at Pascal's wager, which is always a fun exercise in thought, examining what is, if you will, the cost-benefit analysis and the kind of practical argument for God's existence. Then we turn and look at some of the more classic atheists, Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche, and at the end of today's lecture, focusing primarily on both Hume, the height of empiricism, and of Karl Marx and his Communist Manifesto. Couldn't be more delighted to share this with you. It runs for about an hour and a half, and we took questions kind of intermittently in the course of the lecture, so I do beg your indulgence if the questions weren't always articulate. Hopefully the answers were themselves. So whether you're on the go or taking it slow, many blessings as you enjoy today's show. All right, welcome once again to our talks on faith and atheism, especially new atheism. Father Michael, I'm joined by Father Justin. A pleasure to be with you here again. Tonight, we're going to look at, give them some of that old-timey anti-religion. So we're going to move from the new atheists to perhaps what we would call or called the masters of suspicion, some of the classics, Nietzsche, Marx, and Freud. And so we're going to kind of shape our arguments, or at least our look into that, into some of their thought as well, coming from those atheism. Now, we're going to begin. We picked up last time that thread, though, of St. Thomas Aquinas and his investigation into proofs for the existence of God. And so we're going to just briefly summarize. We just, I think, got to that very first of the five ways, if you remember from last time, those who have been here, and to continue delve into that, to kind of bridge us into the masters of suspicion for this evening. Before we launch into that, though, it's kind of a little bit of at this point, a time for an opportunity for humor. Are you?
He's got one of those smiles eyes.
We don't rehearse this, so he never knows what I'm gonna. We're never gonna know what to say. It's a tradition at this point to start with a very scintillating moment of humor. Here's the joke. It was actually inspired by Shelley talking about foxholes, that there are no atheists in foxholes. You've heard of this expression, like no one can truly believe in God when there's a moment of intense duress. And there's the story told of, in fact, we had Mike Lilladal talk at the our coffee house of growing up in Alaska, and in fact, we have a house in Alaska. And Father Justin, actually, you spent some time in Alaska, is that
I
right?
I did.
That's right. How many years were you in Alaska?
Well, only one, but I usually visit a couple times a year. At least I try to.
It's wonderful. Yeah, so we have the cathedral in Anchorage, a beautiful place. And so we went out. I went out. Father Vincent, who is a classmate of mine, was at the time, a number of years ago, the pastor there. So he says, come on up and give some talks. I'd never been to Alaska, so I went. And after giving the talk, I had kind of a day to kind of see the city, but I wanted to kind of get out and went out to a place called Talkeetna. It's out in the boonies. You would know it anyway. They just got on the road and drove, and once you get out of the city, there's nothing there. But they said, indeed, that there's lots of hiking around there, but they warn you about bears. In fact, you had to take one of those little bear horns, you know, that you had to... Well, anyway, I get out there, and then I had to buy one at the shop, and I went in to get one of these air horns for the bears, and I said, you know, which one should I buy? And he's showing me the right one to buy, and I said, does anyone ever see bears? And he says, oh, yes, you better believe it. In fact, he says, I have a friend. And he went out, and he was hiking, and I said, oh, and he says, well, I can see you're obviously, your dress, you look like a priest there. And I said, yeah. And he says, well, my friend, he's not only is he not religious or Catholic, he doesn't really even believe in God. But there's this one time when he went out and he was hiking and hears a little rustle in the bushes. You know, as he kind of quickens his pace and all of a sudden keep going. And right behind him, he hears some growling. He turns around. There's a large, large grizzly bear, which you know are the most dangerous of bears, and turns, and in that moment, just like in the foxhole, he says, oh God, if you save me in this moment, I will believe in you. I will know that you are all powerful. And he hears a voice come down from heaven that says, you didn't believe me for all these years, and in this moment, you're really going to have faith? And he says, yes, perhaps, God, it is a little hypocritical, but rather than gifting me with that grace of faith, at least give the bear a sense of faith. Make the bear religious and Catholic. And God says, deal, it's done. And the heavens close up. Man turns and has a very satisfied smile on his face. The bear kind of hunkers down, gets in position looking very quiet, very peaceful, lifts his paw and begins to say, in the name of the Father, of the Son, of the Holy Spirit, bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts.
You know, when you laugh, you just encourage this kind of behavior.
Had to. Thank you, Sean. Inspired me to make. Okay, so now
all of Father Michael Hurley's stories are this factual, by the way, completely 100% accurate.
Speaking of factual, we're gonna head to the five ways. Just a little overview. When folks point out the five ways, sometimes they're engaged at the level of someone looking for, if you will, kind of a comprehensive proof for the existence of God. To note the context here, the five ways are the very beginning of Thomas's Summa, and he doesn't actually conclude his treatment of the one God, and in fact, the Christian God, until question 26. So this, we're just going to look at one question in one article, and there's 26 of these. So to see these at a snapshot just at the very beginning is not the full treatment. So we're not going to be able to get into all of the different consequences and things that would flow from this essential argument. The other thing to notice is that these arguments are written for, if you will, beginners in theology. And you might assume, I think as well, that if you're studying theology, you kind of already buy into the thesis that God exists, right? And so these are more like shorthand kind of ways, if you will. That's what you might call them, ways, shorthand. If you're looking for perhaps more fulsome things, he talks in his Metaphysics, or at least the introduction to, there is commentary on Aristotle's Metaphysics. So just to say these arguments tonight, just as Thomas kind of sketches them, we're going to sketch these five different ways. And all of them, if you remember, argue from, well, I'll ask it this way. Do they argue from cause to effect or from effect to cause? Do you remember that from last time? From effect to cause. So each one of the five ways starts with something that everyone can notice. Start from creation and then argue back as a kind of mode of discourse to the necessity of a cause for that effect, from creation to a creator. The first way is from motion. And he says, the first and most manifest way is the argument from motion. Whatever is in motion is put in motion by another, for nothing can be in motion except it is in potentiality toward that which is in his motion. It's therefore impossible that in the same respect, in the same way, a thing should both be mover and moved, that is, should move itself. Therefore, whatever is in motion must be put in motion by another. And if that which is put into motion be itself put into motion, then this needs me be put in motion by another, another, and so forth. And again, but this cannot go on to infinity because there would be no first mover and consequently no other mover and consequently no motion in front of us now in this moment. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover put into motion by no other and this everyone understands to be God. So notice a few things here. First of all, the conclusion is not the Christian God that we know. It's not a personal God. It's simply, if you will, the name for the cause of motion, what sustains the ability from something to be in one place at one time and in an intervening place at a different time. There has to be something that is that efficient cause of the motion. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, no, so, and we'll take questions. Well, I'm happy to take questions anytime, but for the sake, yeah, no, so gravity is going to be a force. They knew about, obviously, everyone knows about gravity. So this, it's not, yeah. They did have a very, but this argument doesn't, that's excellent, so I'll clarify that. This argument does not depend on anything scientific in the sense of what we would consider science. It just, well, it's the only thing it assumes from a scientific realm is that for something to be affected, there must be a cause behind it, right? So in other words, he does have a different cosmology, but he's not arguing that his cosmology doesn't necessarily affect, if you will, his conclusions. So just to recap, nothing can put itself into motion, but requires another to move it. Therefore, anything is put into motion must be put into motion by something else. And there can't be an infinite regress of movers, or there would be no beginning of motion, and therefore there's a first mover, something that moves without itself being in motion, and this we call God.
Gravity moves things, but it doesn't move itself. It's not a moving thing that causes nothing to move.
Sure. So you're talking about the motion of gravity, but what caused gravity?
So you mean what? But, so you're saying that by the fact that this force exists, the thing that created the force is
gravity. Exactly. And not only that, gravity is just the attraction of two bodies, right? What causes that? Yeah, and if you don't know the answer, that's good, because no one knows the answer to that. You're not alone. Science doesn't have a unified theory of what gravity. I mean, you can explain it, you can calculate it, you obviously observe it. It's the reason why we're not floating, you know, right now, right? You know, but as for science, and this kind of points to, there's a, when he talks about in the fifth way, that things tend toward a certain, he talks specifically about gravity, that things have their natural place, like rocks always fall. And he says, in that there's a kind of, if you can say, there has to be mind behind that kind of order and intentionality. If I was really in doubt if this glass or this cup that I'm holding would fall, we'd do a little experiment, but I think we're 99.9999 sure it's going to fall, because it always does. Well, he says, because you do that with anything, there has to be mind behind it. There has to be a reason for that very force to exist. But this is not looking specifically at forces of nature. This is looking at efficient cause that we observe in nature. So that's a different argument, but it's one that he does take up in the.
Yeah, and actually, interestingly enough, the cosmology that Aquinas is working with at his point in history was Aristotle's, and Aristotle actually had a more robust notion of things having their own kind of proper motion. So if anything, if the science of it made the difference, we would actually be dealing with a more autonomous universe. In other words, things have their own proper motions, and in the absence of an obstacle, they go there. You know, they move. So it really wasn't a matter of Aquinas saying, you know, we don't have any kind of natural motion. Aquinas acknowledged a kind of natural motion. But what's behind the natural motion? Is, in other words, to say that there's natural motion isn't a satisfying explanation for us. We want to know, well, what's behind that?
So see if this doesn't make this clear. This is really, and this is for these first three ways, they really argue from this idea, we talked a little bit of last time, of potency to act. In other words, there are two ways of being. There is something that is, and there's something that is not. And in between the is and the is not is the can be, right? So there is not, and the can be, and then there's different ways of being can be. There's a can be which, in a sense, is made to or ordered to being in existence or being in is, and that's what he says when you have motion. You have something that can be, which finds itself, if you will, being actualized or becoming an is, and that's what motion is. It's this This could be here.
Bill Clinton doesn't have anything on Aquinas.
That's right. This is. As you got to be careful when you're saying that to a man with holding water. Because although this water is in this glass, it can be in another place. And so the example that Father Justin used last time was bleach. The bleach sitting next to the washer has the potential of cleaning our whites once it's actualized, once it's actually put into the mix and made part of the washing machine. Something can't be both a can-be, a potency, and act at the same time. And so you have to add bleach to the loads of whites in order to actualize it. And since it takes something, another ingredient, if you will, a catalyst, to make something that can be into an is, we're saying that underlying, if you will, call it whatever you want, actualization process, or force is the wrong word to use, but that what kicks that off has to be something that itself is not put into action by anything else. There has to be, at the end of the day, some self-actualizing actualizer, and that's who we call God, the one who starts it. The second way is very close, talking about efficient causality, making a fire making food hot, my pushing you to cause you to fall into a pool or other
it's been known to happen.
I was thinking of Dunk Dominican this Saturday and so forth. In the first way, he says, in the world of sense, we find there is an order of efficient causes. There is no case, neither is it indeed possible, in which a thing is found to be the efficient cause of itself. So it will be prior to itself, which is impossible. Now, in an efficient cause, it is not possible to go on to infinity. If there be no first cause among efficient cause, there is no ultimate nor any immediate cause. Therefore, it is necessary to admit a first efficient cause to which everyone gives the name of God. So once again, the efficient causality is once again what makes something to come to be, come into existence. And you can't.
So if you think of a train, you can have passenger car, all the way down the line. But if there ain't no engine, train's not going to go anywhere.
That's right. And part of all these proofs is a strategy that Aquinas uses for the infinite regress. He says there you can't go all the way back infinitely, or else you don't have, if you don't have a start, you don't have a finish. Where the whole premise was that we see this in motion now, therefore there must have been a beginning to it. And I think just naturally we think of the idea of this infinity as being a temporal infinity. And get this, this might shock you. Aquinas thinks that it's possible for the world to be eternal. Infinite. Thinks the world could be infinite. The only reason we know the world isn't infinite is why? Genesis 1.
We have some pretty good testimony against that.
Yeah, so by revelation we know that the earth had a beginning, in the beginning, right? But he says outside of that, philosophically, there is no reason philosophically why the world couldn't be eternal. So that's even more of a, I mean, I think if modern science heard that, they think, well, that ends the story right there. If the world could be eternal, therefore there's no need for God, right? But Aquinas is asking a different question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Right, just because there is something, and even if that something has been infinitely, in terms of time, existing, there never has been a time when the world didn't exist, it still doesn't follow that there has to be a reason why there's something rather than nothing. Does that make sense?
You could put it in terms of the Big Bang, for instance, to say that it all comes from the Big Bang. You could ask the question, well, where does the Big Bang come from? Supposing a scientist then came up to you and said, no, the Big Bang was dependent upon a Big Bang before that, and then a Big Bang before that. It's always been an eternal cycle of different Big Bangs. Would it still make sense to ask the question, well, where did the Big Bang come from? Absolutely it would, because you want to know where the whole thing, infinite though it may be, where did that come from? Because it doesn't explain itself. And that's what Aquinas is getting at in his ways.
Yeah, and so there's a difference between what we might call accidental ordered series, so the very famous one, the chicken and the egg, which one came first, right? Well, you can go all the way back, chicken, egg. And for Aquinas, this is not a problem. This is not the kind of argument he's using. He says you could go all the way back infinitely with chickens and eggs. That's not a problem.
If you had infinite time, you could have as infinite eggs and infinite chickens.
Why? Because there's no causality from the existence of the egg. Once the egg is in existence, it's not dependent on the chicken anymore, right? It exists independently. And once you have a chicken, if it's not laying an egg, it doesn't necessarily have an egg, right? So there are acts that they're not caused. The existence of the egg might presuppose a chicken at one point, but once it's been laid, it doesn't need it for its existence. Aquinas is saying for this to be moving right now, not only is there need to be a proximate efficient cause, me throwing it, me staying on the ground, being held up, the forces of gravity and all the rest, but there has to be a reason why the whole system itself exists. And so it's more like, not the chicken and the egg, but you may, we've got my laser pointer right here, right? And imagine you have a series of mirrors that can deflect or reflect, and someone, I'd shine a little laser beam right there, and it bounces off, and someone would be observing around the corner this little beam of light, right? Now, it's gone through all these different kind of sets of motions, but once the laser is turned off, the whole series is shut down, right? It's in order for that beam of light to be seen, there has to be an active cause acting right here and now. That's the explanation for all the successive chain of events. Another image that's often used is a hanger, right? I go, tonight after my prayers, I'm going to hang up my habit, right? Hey, put it on the hanger, and what's on the hanger, right? I got to put it on a hook. What supports the hook? The door, the hinges, the door frame, the wall. Like, just to put up the hanger includes a whole system of structure that all has to be in existence and holding it together, or else the habit collapses and I need an iron in the morning, which is nothing worse than that. Anyway, so the effect we see demands an active cause acting on it right now. And so there's a contradiction going on. This infinity to regress is not just a temporal infinity of regress. It's not like myself to, you know, my parents to my great grandparents. That's an accidental series in the sense of they don't have to be acting right now. It's a right now. There has to be an existence for why there is something upholding something like a universe that kind of is holding it in existence. So another example: it is absurd to claim that a brush can paint by itself if it simply has a long enough handle. Right. Likewise, hanging a pot must be attached to a ceiling, no matter how many links in the chain. Right. There has to be something that actually is moving it. And this is the third way. And the third way basically talks about possibility and necessity. He says we find in nature things that are possible to be and not be, since they are found to be generated and to corrupt. But it is impossible for these to always exist, for that which is possibly not to be at some time is not. Therefore, if everything is possible not to be, then at one time there would be nothing in existence. And if this were true, even now there would be nothing in existence, because that which does not exist only begins to exist by something already existing. Therefore, not all beings are merely possible, but there must exist something of the existence of which is actually necessary. But every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by something or not. Impossible, once again, to go on to infinity. Therefore, there has to be something which of its own existence is necessary and not caused by anything else, and this is what we call God. So to put it, and this is I'll call sometimes colloquially the Murphy's Law, right? What's Murphy's Law? If something can go wrong, can go wrong, it will go wrong. So this is another.
And you didn't know, but that was a metaphysical principle.
That's right.
Not just a good idea.
Exactly.
It's the law.
So he's saying if something has the ability not to exist, even if it's existing now, if it has at some point it will not exist. If it has that possibility, it's a Murphy's Law. And so the fact that there is something now that exists which could or could not be in existence, at one time it's not. Therefore, there has to be something that underlies it, which it itself has no possibility of not existing ever, and that power not caused by another. All of these proofs depend on two things. First of all, the idea of potency to act, the is and the is not, and the process of going from the is not to the can be to the is, and if you will, this necessity that there cannot be an infinite regress. There has to be something that explains it, and it's not simply in terms of the physical explanation like gravity or even a temporal explanation like the chicken and egg, but an explanation right now. Why is there something rather than nothing is, in a sense, in a microcosm, why does this water make its way all the way over to Father Justin in a minute? What's underlying that? You can have lots of explanations on the natural causes of that. We can break that down in physical ways, but when you ask that question metaphysically, there has to be something that makes the whole system hang together, like the hanger and the habit. All right. Fourth way, hand it off.
Very good. The fourth way is a little bit of fun, I think, because, well, for at least one reason that Richard Dawkins actually misunderstands it and gives a very fun kind of caricature of it, and so we'll pick that apart. So here's the actual argument. Among things, there are some more and some less good, true, noble, and the like. But more or less are predicated of different things, according as they resemble in their different ways something which is the maximum, so that there is something which is truest, something that is best, something noblest, and consequently something which is uttermost being. Now, the maximum in any genus or kind of thing is the cause of all in that genus or kind of thing. Therefore, there must also be something which is to all beings the cause of their being goodness and every other perfection, and this we call God. So insofar as there are things that are true or existing or beautiful or good, we can say that they are they owe that goodness, that truth, that beauty, that goodness to God, who is supremely good. Now here is Dawkins' objection, and I think it's fun. This could either be said of Dawkins himself, or could be Dawkins. In other words, he doesn't like this argument, but I don't like his argument. So I guess we're in the same boat here. Here's his response in The God Delusion. He says, "That's an argument. You might as well say people vary in smelliness, because we can make the comparison only by reference to a perfect maximum of conceivable smelliness. Therefore, there must exist a preeminently peerless stinker, and we call him God. Or substitute any dimension of comparison you like and derive an equally fatuous conclusion." As before, Dawkins has it very wrong, and that's actually very helpful to us, because it actually allows us to get the fourth way right. He is... Dawkins is actually exemplifying how we should not engage our opponents. So the very fact that he has this kind of objection, I think, actually does not speak well of him, because Aquinas is a pretty smart guy. If Aquinas put forth such a bad, bad argument, don't you think Aquinas would have noticed? And don't you think a whole bunch of people who came after Aquinas would notice? And Dawkins basically says, well, no, I'm that wonderful. I'm going to come and show how this is just perfectly absurd. He doesn't really give the tradition or Aquinas the benefit of the doubt, at least being reasonably intelligent.
It was fun, though. I have to admit, I laughed when I heard that God is the ultimate stinker.
Yeah. Yes.
It was funny. Rhetorically, I appreciate it.
Yes, this is actually Dawkins at his relative best. So remember the straw man argument is that we, if we seriously engage our opponent, what we're looking for is the strongest version of what they're saying. We want the most charitable read. We want to give our opponent every benefit of the doubt and see if there's any truth there. What we ought not to do is caricature it, find its weakest, incarnation, and then knock it over. So we need to engage a real living person rather than a straw man, a scarecrow. And this is essentially what Dawkins is doing, is he's providing a very weak form of Aquinas' argument, and he fails to notice a couple of important things in the process. First, the argument centers around the idea of cause. So, and you notice that Dawkins' explanation doesn't involve cause at all, right? Your smelliness and my smelliness are not, as far as we know, related, unless we've been somehow rolling around in garbage together. But as far as we know, I don't have to be the cause of your stinkiness and vice versa. So, but that's not the case in Aquinas' argument. In Aquinas' argument, there is this notion of cause, that the maximum of any genus is the cause of all in that genus. So therefore, there must be something which is to all beings the cause of their being goodness and the like. So it's not what Dawkins is actually taking it for. There's an additional dimension.
And just to clarify, the example that Aquinas uses is fire. So it's a causative when you're heating, when you have heat and you're communicating fire, there's a causality there, right? Whereas in the Dawkins argument, it's the stinkiness is not necessarily related. There's no causal, at least apparent causality.
That's right. Pretend like we're going in the reverse. We have something that's really, really hot and something that's only a tiny little bit hot. Can the tiny bit hot thing explain the really, really hot thing? It can't, right? It's not hot enough to affect that. So you have something that's just warm, and then you have something that's bursting into flame. It's so hot. The warm thing is never going to have caused the really, 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 really hot thing, right? It just doesn't have enough oomph. The principle behind here, and this is a very technical phrase, is you can't give what you don't got.
Can you say that in Latin?
Only at parties. Secondly, we're not talking about incidental and material properties for the most part. We're talking about spiritual qualities. So notice that Aquinas' argument is talking about goodness, truth, being, things that are really at the very top of all categories of what exists. So there's spiritual qualities that do not and cannot arise from something's material composition alone. In other words, we can fully explain your stinkiness from perhaps not having used deodorant, or maybe it's been a little bit too long since you showered, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to milk this metaphor for any more. But
will,
the idea is...
I will say, and this is true, there are new shower heads in the priory. This is a true story.
That's how I keep the troops from rebelling. The idea is that transcendental attributes of being, truth, beauty, and goodness need a cause, and that the cause possesses these qualities to a superlative degree. Again, I can't account for something that's really beautiful by something that's less beautiful. I can't account for something that's true by something that is only kind of true, right? I need the maximum truth, the maximum being the maximum goodness, to be able to explain the goodness, truth, and beauty in the world. That's a lot more plausible argument than Richard Dawkins' supreme stinker argument, which is fun, but not helpful.
The fifth way.
The fifth way. Okay, this is where the rubber hits the road, because the fifth way is going to be Aquinas' version of some kind of intellectual order, intelligent design. And I put that in quotation marks because we'll want to qualify that description of the fifth way in just a moment. So here is the actual text. We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident from their acting always, or nearly always, in the same way, so as to obtain the best result. Hence it is plain that not fortuitously, but designedly, do they achieve their end. Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move toward an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. Oops. So, just to say at this point, and I will go into this a little bit in more depth in the next couple slides, that it can be very easy to say, oh, what he's arguing for is intelligent design. Despite some similarities, we have to carefully distinguish the fifth way from certain arguments from design. There's a difference between not all arguments from design are created equal. Aquinas is referring primarily to the regularity and order exhibited in individual things, not an overall harmony, although that's true too. Individual things or species, not necessarily the world as a whole. So Aquinas' fifth way starts out with a very simple insight into the reality of our world. Things do not occur in a haphazard manner, but tend to the same results. So we don't plant acorns and wind up with a field of sunflowers, nor do jellyfish produce sharks or unicorns. Hitting a baseball into a window has a very predictable result. Things generally tend to work in a regular fashion. And they usually tend to work for their own integrity and persistence. So you're not going to just have things spontaneously die. We actually look for a cause from the outside that interferes with its well-being. Things actually mature and grow into their adult forms, and they live general lifespan. So there's an order that things have, which shows that there's a kind of design behind that. Now, what we're talking about is what has been given the term teleology. It describes the reliable ordering of natural things and activity towards ends, both external, that is, when I'm actually trying to do something, get something done, and internal, when we're talking about the way things function just as they are by themselves. Now, during the Enlightenment, teleology was often confused with purpose in an almost conscious awareness or decision-making kind of sense. And here I have to just emphasize that that's not what Aquinas is saying. Aquinas is not a pantheist, so he's not trying to say that everything has a little bit of intelligence and makes up its mind whether it wants to do X, Y, or Z, but that things function in regular fashion. There's a general regularity and order to the universe that we can explain, and that that is a sign of God's existence. The Enlightenment tried to get rid of this particular dimension of the world and tended to posit a kind of mechanistic universe, right? Simply pushes and pulls. Teleology was pretty easy to eliminate from physics, but much harder to do with biology and other sciences. The very concept of function in biology, for instance, betrayed this idea of individual things acting for determinate ends, and ends which not only tended to benefit the whole organism, but actually would benefit an entire ecosystem. So you had forms of cooperation and mutual support. By its nature, intelligence acts for an end, so it's a sign of our human intelligence that we don't simply do things and say to ourselves, now, why did I do that? But there's usually a very, very clear answer. I go to the Coke machine to get a Coke, and I want a Coke because I'm thirsty, that kind of thing. But what explains the end-directedness of things? Even Dawkins' version of natural selection, which, of course, is going to be his alternative to teleology, assumes rather than explains this principle. It really assumes teleology. Natural selection is a reliable mechanism working for the perpetuation of certain more efficient replicators, what Dawkins gave the term selfish gene to. But notice that the consistent, reliable working of this mechanism for the benefit of the replicator is assumed. In other words, there's already a kind of order hardwired into natural selection that makes natural selection work. Where does this order come from? Dawkins obviously can't explain that because natural selection is, for him, the ultimate explanation. Now, this brings up the idea of intelligent design. And when most people talk about intelligent design, what they're really talking about or referring to, or they tend to refer to, is the argument from William Paley from the 19th century. It tends to have a certain kind of logic, and it goes something like this. If you stumble across a pocket watch, you wouldn't be tempted to think that it just kind of happened to be there, and there's no explanation for it. It's not a alluring explanation for us to simply say that pocket watch is just the pure product of chance. Its natural forces in the field happen to go together and build this pocket watch. No, we're going to think that there was an actual designer to this pocket watch. This is the analogy that Paley uses to talk about the universe. We look at the intricacy, the complexity, and the harmony of things, and we say, my goodness, with that kind of complexity, this must be the product of an intelligent mind. So the works of nature exhibit these kind of pocket watch sorts of attributes, and we think that they're expressive of an intelligent designer. Now, here's where I actually agree with Dawkins.
Oh, no.
I know. Every once in a while, I agree with Dawkins, and it's always very disturbing. but Dawkins actually is right to point out that Paley's version of the intelligent design argument is not a strong argument. Now, what I will deny is that he actually shows that it's false. And Dawkins himself sometimes suggests that, but doesn't actually claim that outright. But Dawkins is right to characterize certain versions of intelligent design, including Paley's, as problematic. For instance, it's actually a relatively weak strategy, and again, if you took a logic class, this would be the kind of thing that you'd learn right up front. Arguments from analogy tend to be relatively weak arguments. Why? Because you actually have to establish that there is a precise likeness, that something truly is an analogy to something else. And it's very easy for someone else to come along and say, yeah, they're not that alike after all. No, and then your whole argument from analogy falls apart. So all Dawkins really has to do is come up and say, no, the universe really isn't like a pocket watch. It really doesn't have that kind of irreducible complexity. And this is where he spends a lot of his effort, is this idea of irreducible complexity, that he complains constantly that people who are for intelligent design and appeal to this irreducible complexity that really only God can account for have never really actually shown that the complexity is, in fact, irreducible. Dawkins is very quick to point out that a lot of the complexity we see is actually quite explainable in terms of, again, that wonderful mechanism of natural selection. So natural selection is a little bit of his Rosetta Stone for solving all problems, but it does actually put forward, I think, a very real challenge to arguments from design that have this form, Paley-style arguments from design. Sorry, there was a question? Very good. And that would be kind of my perfect. That's really my response to Dawkins would be there's already a kind of order and design within natural selection that itself requires an explanation. Now, Dawkins would come back at me and say what?
It's the survival of the species is what the basis for natural selection is Darwin's theory of survival of species. That there's an instinct. See where this goes. There's instinctive desire and drive within any living thing to survive. And that characteristics that allow that thing to survive in that environment will get passed on from generation to generation. And that, I believe all that. But I think what you're getting at is that Dawkins doesn't explain the survival of the species.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, what makes things work for their own integrity in the first place? That seems to be a key component for the very idea of natural selection. That's not even seen by Dawkins. Dawkins, that's not even on his radar screen. He does not get that. The fifth way kind of passes him by because he immediately reduces it to a different argument that I think is easier to refute. Again, there's a little bit of a straw man fallacy going on. We don't actually read what Aquinas says. We kind of assume that Aquinas says what I think he says. And again, maybe Dawkins is modeling exactly how we should not be treating our the people we disagree with. We should be really trying to figure out what they say on their own terms and not just putting them in a general category of positions about the universe, about God.
So even if you could show that it was not, that its complexity was not irreducible, that it did depend on regularities in nature, where did the lawful regularities?
Absolutely. That is totally the point. You have to ask, okay, where do these mechanisms themselves come from? Yes, absolutely. Now, interestingly enough, Dawkins is not alone in critiquing these forms of intelligent design. So it made the news a handful of years ago. The former director of the Vatican Observatory, Father George Coyne, yes, he is a Jesuit, but he made news by speaking against intelligent design. And what he really had was not the fifth way in mind, but he had this Paley-style argument in mind and was attentive to its weakness. Now, Father Coyne may be a Jesuit, but he obviously doesn't have a problem with there being an intelligent designer. He's a believer, after all. His critique centered on the form of the argument, including with, you know, he agrees with Dawkins here, the very notion of irreducible complexity as being a little bit problematic. But one of his bigger objections was, again, that somehow we had to identify a kind of deficiency in our explanation of natural causes in order to make room for God. What's another name for that procedure? the God of the gaps, right? So we're looking for that place where we don't really have very firm physical laws, or the natural laws kind of break down, and somehow so there's a kind of space for God to kind of wiggle in and do his magic. Is that a good model of God? No, because God can do whatever he wants, whether there are natural laws operating them or not. And he's the cause behind those natural laws when they're there. So God is equally present to a part of the universe that runs just fine. We don't have to look for something that's a little bit out of whack or somehow unexplained and then insert God there. The God of the gaps is very problematic. And Father Coyne thought that certain intelligent design arguments, Paley style again, tended to give us this kind of God of the gaps picture of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
When it comes to design and the God of the Gap, I thought God of the Gap talked about designer jeans. Is that right or no? Is that right? Or?
Materialistic idolatry, yes. Oh, boy.
Unfortunately, I can't deny that.
There might be some creative editing later
There's
on.
There's always editing, the belt sander of talks.
That's right. Some things just end up on the cutting room floor. When it comes to Aquinas' five ways, Dawkins' most fundamental objection is that God is not himself immune to an explanatory regress. Again, remember his positive argument that God is actually more improbable than any kind of other explanation, because God simply kicks the football down or kicks the can down the road. Once we posit God, we have to explain how God comes, which of course misses the whole point of the arguments and the classical understanding of God. God doesn't need an explanation. He's the uncaused cause. He's the necessary being, which is the whole point of the five ways. So although he insists that God requires an explanation, despite the fact that the very definition of God used by Aquinas in the tradition is a necessary being, an uncaused cause, he still insists that this is part of the problem. And again, talk about missing the point of every single one of Aquinas' ways. Every single one of Aquinas' ways is telling you that God, the thing that we call God, is the necessary being, the uncaused cause, the thing that doesn't need the explanation. If you don't think the argument works, it can't be just because you deny the conclusion.
Yeah, so he takes proof in the sense of something. I presume usually you can mean it to, it requires an explanation. But when you're talking about God, it's not as if God requires an explanation. God is the explanation for why everything else is, right? So it's the other way around. Dawkins is looking to say, how can we explain God? Well, it doesn't make sense. There's always, well, no, the philosophical way is to see that God is, once again, from effects to cause, is the very explanation on why we see what we see. So it's completely inverted.
Yeah. Again, we might just accuse Dawkins of almost just non-engagement. He's just not talking about the same thing. Only he tells us he's talking about the same thing. That's where he gets himself into trouble.
Is this a plug for a DSP class?
It is. It is. Incidentally, has not escaped the notice of logicians that omniscience and omnipotence, and this is a quote from Dawkins again, are mutually incompatible. So he thinks being all-knowing and all-powerful are mutually incompatible. That's weird, right? And here's his explanation. If God is omniscient, he must already know how he is going to intervene to change the course of history using his omnipotence. But that means he can't change his mind about his intervention, which means he is not omnipotent. I heard a couple. In other words, somehow changing one's mind becomes the criteria for omnipotence, because God knows too much. He can't be all-powerful. Does this make any sense? The answer is no, it makes no sense. This indicates actually a larger problem for the new atheists, an inability to conceive of the possibility of a mode of being different from our own. So if you page through the God delusion, you get this sense of, well, God has to be an intelligent creature like us. He doesn't include the like us, but that would be in parentheses as an explanation. And therefore, since he's an intelligent designer like us, he has to be the product of natural selection like us. Now, what in the world makes us think that God has to be like us?
Narcissism.
Yeah, well, we could at least say it's a failure of the imagination, right? There are other possibilities, right, Horatio, in this world. So,
and I think it also can be a kind of missense of the idea of we're like God. That means a flawed logic.
Yep.
Saying we're like God, and therefore God must be like us.
And we'll...
But I don't think it's not true that God has to be like us. He, because we're like him.
Yes.
We have the limitations we have.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, so which resembles which? Your reflection and you. Well, you could say that you resemble your reflection, but isn't that slightly misleading? It seems to think that the reflection is primary and that you're secondary, right? Your reflection resembles you. You're primary. So we have the image and likeness of God, but God is primary here, right? We only resemble and we have a likeness. We've kind of inverted it, and we'll see that inversion going on when we reach the old atheists. They're actually more transparent about that and less apologetic, which I actually like.
All right, so now a little bit of a segue. So we've covered Aquinas and Dawkins. We're going to segue into the Masters of Suspicion by looking at a couple of arguments which perhaps are not the most philosophically rigorous in the same way, but have a tendency toward, if you will, a gravity toward looking at God's existence. And one of my favorites is by articulated by Blessed John Henry Newman, and he has what he calls the illative sense of God's existence, a sense in the transcendent in our concrete human experience. So in other words, to reflect upon human experience and then say to ourselves, there's something greater than myself at work here. There's something that transcends human ways of being and human modes of being. So, for example, beauty in nature, right? We've heard this argument before. A beautiful sunset, right? The power of standing next to a waterfall, right? The feeling that just reverberate in your body, the majesty of the natural life, you know, seeing animals kind of at play and things like
that. The Holy Spirit working through the preaching of Father Michael Hurley.
Very illative. the peaceful joy of a family at Christmas, you know, gathering for a meal with family and friends. We all have experience which suggests that there's something transcendent, something that takes us out of a moment. And we know when we're in that experience, when we don't mark the passage of time, right? When you said, you know, oh, I was on a conversation with a good friend, you know, a family member, and 2 hours went like that, right? What do you experience? You're kind of out of yourself, right? There's a sense that you're not marking time, but you're connected in a transcendent way. There's something more than just yourself. You know, beautiful conversation, or people fall in love, right? There's that sense of love, of beauty coming out. So Newman says, if we reflect on these transcendent experiences, they point us to something beyond simply the material. He's particularly keen on reflecting on what we would call the conscience, and he does this in many different ways, but here pointing for the existence of God. In making moral demands on us, our conscience reveals that there is something like a divine conscience, a divine moral legislator that tells us right from wrong. And even though most of these experiences will not be conclusive on their own, as they begin to accumulate over time, they converge into an overall sense, a kind of gravity or weight of probabilities, a moral certainty regarding God's existence. And although not a strict proof, it's a way in which human reason leads us to know God's existence. So for conscience, for example, you know, you're with little children and something happens, there's a little bit of a dispute, and one of them no doubt says, that's not fair, right? That's not fair. We don't suddenly say to that child, we have a budding Aristotle in our midst, right? Look at this philosophy on this kid's a genius.
He's like a Hebrew prophet of old.
Exactly. We say, no, that's a normal human reaction. That the idea of fairness is like one of the very first things we can articulate once we can speak a word and say more than just our parents' name. We have a strong sense of when we're not getting the fullness of what is our due, what is our right, right?
And then when mom and dad come up to them and say, who told you that life was supposed to be fair? I don't know, but somebody did.
Exactly. That's the illative sense, right? We take as normative a sense of right and wrong from when we're young. You know, when we grab the cookie out of the cookie jar and mom comes down, we naturally are a little bashful about saying where we got it, right? We know we've crossed the line, right? Who told us that? We don't need our parents to tell us, you know, what's wrong in every case. We have that in Martin. He says you reflect on that conscience, that base of right and wrong, and there's nothing extraordinary about that. Take, for example, that when we're just reflecting back on Dawkins, he says everyone's born an atheist, right? We have people that by no means in the sense of if you're taking that in terms of a moral kind of gravity. We all have a moral gravity, right? Like I said, you don't point to a child who is able to hit on right and wrong and think that we should put them in a school for the gifted, right? We take that as normative. It's normative to have that kind of conscience.
And that's also one of the reasons, for instance, why it's never a good excuse for us to, you know, go up to the witness stand and say, I know I'm being accused of murder, but no one ever told me that murder was wrong. No one's convinced by that argument, right? And that actually goes way back to Aristotle. That's not a good excuse, says Aristotle. And the reason that is because we have a natural sense of these things. Where does a natural sense come from?
Yeah, and so that's what he's pointing to, a kind of gravity. The other, if you will, not exactly the illative sense, but if you will, a persuasive look, and this kind of goes back to the atheist and foxhole kind of mentality, is what's called Pascal's wager. Just by show of hands, are people familiar with the wager? Oh, yeah, so a smattering. One of my favorite, if you will, articulations of God's existence. And you have to know the context is, Pascal is actually, brings this up, the context, in a seaside town where there's just like lots of gambling. And so he looks around and everyone's playing cards and gambling a lot of wagering. And he says, I can use the very, you know, town entertainment to show you that something like God makes sense. And so what he does is he kind of takes this kind of logical form. He says there's a difference between what you do with your life, just in general, and what you find out upon dying. That is, how you live your life, what you think, and what reality is. And he says if you take those two things as two different, if you distinguish between those two things, what you think the reality is, how you live your life, and what the reality is, what you discover upon your death, he says, imagine the four, if you will, basic logical possibilities. And so he starts, he says, well, what if you, in a sense, live your life, you make a bet that God exists, right? Okay, so now consider the possibilities. If God exists, if you think God exists and you live in a way that God exists, if you bet your whole life on that and you find out that God exists, is true, what do you win?
Eternal salvation.
Infinite reward. Epic
win. Yay, door one.
Every day you've won the lottery, right? For all eternity. Epic win, right? Epic win. Okay, what if you wager on God exists and you find out that there is no God? There's a fail, a bit of a fail, but as he puts it, there hasn't been a huge loss. You've lost maybe, I don't know, you didn't sow your oats the way you wanted to, or, you know, there's a sense in which perhaps you didn't go after the pleasures of life in a way. But he says ultimately, even if you try to do that, there's always a wanting a more and a more and a more. So there's never any satisfaction. So it's a fail, but the loss is temporal. The loss is finite. It's measurable in that way. Okay, so we've got infinite epic win. We've got kind of like temporary loss. What if you wager on there is no God and God does exist? Yeah. Big trouble. Not just trouble.
Oops.
Big trouble. Epic fail. Not just loss, but infinite loss for all eternity, for the rest and continuing on. One day of eternity is the eagle's wing brushing against the mountain of gold. And once every 1,000 years, that eagle's wing brushes against the mountain of gold. Once that mountain erodes by the eagle's light brush every 1,000 years, that's the beginning of eternity.
Eternity's a long time.
Long time. Okay? If you wager on no God and gods exist, infinite loss. If you wager on no God and there is no God, you win. But it's kind of a meaningless win. I mean, what do you actually win? I guess you can say, I told you so. that's about it, right?
You just have confidence in your
Yes, I'm not quite understanding.
What I'm saying is, if you just base your faith totally on this type of wager philosophy, mm-hmm. you know, I would think that just like gambling, you have a sort of a loss of confidence at certain times, and then your behavior would be affected by that.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So Pascal certainly concedes this, and Dawkins makes a big deal out of it as if Pascal didn't know. But yeah, absolutely. So Pascal's doing a kind of thought experiment and doesn't expect anyone to think that faith actually works this way. In other words, you have to be sincere in your beliefs. So you can't just decide that, hey, it's a good bet.
Yeah.
So Pascal is not trying to say that this is the way it actually works. What he's trying to do is motivate us to make that leap of faith. So one of the things, well, anyway, so yes,
yeah.
You're absolutely right. And yeah. that is one hint of many hints that it's not really supposed to be a proof.
Yeah. For example, Dawkins brings up, what if there's an evil God? So, you know, that's another possibility that's not in the four quadrant thing. What if you believe in God, and God does exist, but God is an evil God? Now you have, you're right, but once again, you're in the meaningless win because, as you see in the cartoon, you've got the priest and the rabbi and the imam, and they come to Heaven's Gate, and it's not St. Peter. It's Odin, and they're like, uh-oh.
Whoopsie daisy.
So it's true that Pascal's wager does not directly consider any all permutations of logical possibilities. That's not the point. The point is, as Father Justin was saying, to motivate, he's trying to, once again, his audience is folks who just gamble for a living, and he's saying, okay, if and not for a living, but just for entertainment, and just it's well-known and well-trafficked in, it's, if you will, to spur us, to nudge us, to get us to see, hey, what are our priors? It's an argument from perspective is what it is, to give us a perspective. That's why I gave the little example of the eagle brushing the wing. You appeal to the imagination and to that sense of what really gets me up in the morning in terms of motivation. Well, thinking this has lasting eternal value. If I know what I do today is going to have eternal meaning, right? If we truly believe that, I bring that to mind with a morning prayer, my day is going to go very different than if I'm not motivated that way, right? That doesn't prove anything, but it certainly gives perspective and focus, and that's what Pascal is after. Certainly, Pascal is often associated with, it's after all, has his name, his wager, and it's just one step on the way. It's a kind of inspiration for hope that is to invest our life in believing in God, and it moves on what we call the practical, existential, human level, rather than the theoretical, metaphysical level. So we can't, it's, once again, it doesn't, we shouldn't expect that proof to do more than Pascal himself was trying to do with it. What he was trying to do, motivate a bunch of degenerate gamblers living a life of faith to stop, basically to stop gambling and make one big bet on God. And so before we launch in, we have to ask ourselves, and this will take us into our next theme. Does belief diminish our existence? If we look beyond proofs and arguments, there's a kind of important basic difference between Christianity and atheism and that of Dawkins and more classical atheism. Dawkins and the classical atheists clearly enter the debate with the idea that faith diminishes existence, we are less human, and we fall short of our potential and what we ultimately might be if we seriously entertain the idea of God. And for Dawkins, remember, it's dumb, either dumb or dangerous. Right? A thoughtless acceptance of improbable and ridiculous ends up pushing aside rational scientific inquiry. But the old atheists, or if you will, the classics, will present other ways in which they think God holds us back, and each one in different ways. So we've chosen three that kind of give the span of kind of the economic, political life, the, if you will, the life of the mind and psychology, and ultimately the moral life, the three philosophers that look at different aspects of human being and human living in terms of economics and some politics, the life of the mind, and the life of morals, and say that belief in God holds us back into full human thriving. With that, we enter into the old classical atheist.
So I've already hinted at this already, but I have to be very frank. I don't think Richard Dawkins or the other new atheists are particularly worth reading, unless you want to have a really penitential Lent, and then they're good. And this isn't because they don't agree with this Christianity. We can obviously learn an awful lot of from people who disagree with us. It's just because their reasoning isn't that good, and they're just not top-rate thinkers. There are, however, some atheists who are really worth your time, and we're going to talk about those beginning tonight and then really extensively next week. And I do recommend reading them critically and carefully. In fact, I offer a couple classes on them at the DSPT. These old atheists include intellectual giants like Sigmund Freud, Karl Marx, and Friedrich Nietzsche. And we'll also talk about David Hume and maybe a little Jean-Paul Sartre, too. So it's a fest. It's a cornucopia of intellectual delights.
Start with Hume.
Okay, humor me. We'll do Hume. David Hume, 1711 to 1776, so he's about the, American colonies kind of time frame. He was a Scottish philosopher, historian, economist, essayist, and diplomat. So he was, in many ways, a Renaissance man. He is best known for his thoroughgoing empiricism, and by that we mean that he really believed that things came directly with our sense encounter with things in the world. So everything begins with sensation. And he was so thoroughgoing in this empiricism, he tended to be pretty skeptical in general and about a number of things we take for granted in particular. So Hume is not very impressed with causal reasoning. He thinks causality is actually something that our mind does all on its own. I basically see things that tend to go together and I kind of parse it out and say cause and effect. They always go together, therefore one must cause the other. He doesn't believe that we actually have a self as such. So he says, examine your mind, examine your experience. Do you ever come across an object like a self? No, we come across blue chairs and we come across other people, but we don't come across a self per se. So self is something that he kind of throws out the window. He has an idea of morality as basically a kind of statement about your preference. So all this time when you have been saying murder bad, it's been a lot closer to, ooh, murder, than you thought. Or, I don't like murder. It's really an expression of your emotions combined with a sense of the negative consequences of a particular act. So he has a very different kind of explanation for our moral judgments. An explanation that a number of philosophers have pointed out is original and interesting, but not thoroughly compelling when it comes to actually answering to our intuitions about what moral judgments actually are. Yeah?
What are your emotions if there is no self?
Yes, that is a good question. So, yeah. So there is you, but you don't have a self per se. So he is not he's not denying that there's an organism at which you identify with. But when we use pronouns like you, or especially when you use pronoun I, we're actually talking about a grammatical feature that really has no correlate in the world. It's very complicated, but very interesting stuff. And then, of course, finally, he's really not convinced that anything like God is out there. And we're going to focus on this last one. So I just give you a little taste of the first three. For more on that, you'll have to take my ethics course at the DSPT. I'm a shameless self-promoter. I usually leave that to you, Father Michael. So Hume held a kind of copy theory. This is part of his empiricism. He basically says, we take in impressions of things through our senses, right? We see them, we hear them, etc. These impressions resemble the objects that they are impressions of. So the impression in your head looks like what's out there in the world. There's a kind of copy theory. In turn, our ideas are kind of copy or kind of weak residual echo of our impressions. So he says in his treatise on human nature, all our ideas or weak perceptions are derived from our impressions or strong perceptions. and that we can never think of anything which we have not seen without us or felt in our minds. So if I don't have some kind of experience, direct experience, externally or by a kind of introspection, then there's no idea that I'm going to have in my mind, because everything begins with my having an impression, a sensation of that thing. Yeah.
How do you explain mathematics?
we have a sharp audience tonight, boy. Mathematics comes about by a process of abstraction, which he and Kant following him both unite or link very closely with imagination. So there is a kind of...
You cannot observe mathematics as the one thing, or physics, because you can't account for friction.
Yes, so Hume is going to talk about our imagination. We are able to come up with ideas by reordering our impressions. So you have experienced the color gold, maybe even the substance gold, right? And you have seen mountains. You can, with your imagination, put those two things together and talk about a golden mountain. Doesn't mean you actually have had laid an eyes on a golden mountain, right? Now, would you be able to come up with a golden mountain if you hadn't experienced gold or mountain? For Hume, the answer is no. You have to have experienced both those things. And once you have, your imagination can mix things up. And that's essentially what we do when we come up with the idea of God. So when it comes to God, we have no clear idea of him, and for several reasons. First, we never have any external impression of God. God is a being so remote and incomprehensible, says Hume, who bears much less analogy to any other being in the universe than the sun to a waxen taper, that is, a candle, and who discovers himself only by some faint traces or outlines beyond which we have no authority to ascribe to him any attribute or perfection. So we just are never going to bump into God and to be able to see him or hear him directly. At least this is Hume's argument. He doesn't really take mystical experience very seriously. Yeah? Yeah, so Hume would probably come back and say, but if you have encountered Jesus, what have you actually seen and heard?
A human being.
A human being, that's right.
Oh, we'll get to miracles. Oh, yeah.
We're going to bracket miracles for the time.
Yeah,
that's going to be in the next slide.
Yeah.
So the idea is that we're never going to meet God walking down the street. We're never going to be able to lay eyes on him, as is true for 99% of us. Mystics who have particular visions might be the exception, although mystical experiences are very complicated. So we're not going to factor that in, because Hume doesn't really consider it either. So not considering mystical experiences, we're just not going to ever have a direct encounter with God in that way. We are going to have experiences of God, but they're going to be of a different character. And the character is going to be of the kind that Hume doesn't feel like we have to take that seriously, because he's such a radical empiricist. So without an actual external impression of God, our idea of God tends to be confused and empty. So where does our idea actually come from then, if we have no impressions of God and everything begins with impressions? Well, says Hume, from the workings of our own mind. So the idea of God as meaning an infinitely intelligent, wise, and good being arises from our reflecting on the operations of our own mind and augmenting them without limit, those qualities of goodness and wisdom. So we look at ourselves and we observe the workings of our own mind and say, God is like us, only he doesn't have any kind of human limitations that I have. He doesn't have any of the imperfections that I have. He doesn't have any of the moral intellectual deficiencies. God has a much better memory than I have. He can do equations in mathematics much faster than I can. I basically stretch that to infinity, and I get this idea of God. I basically maximize any good attribute. I get rid of any bad attribute, and I come up with this idea of God. In other words, we use our imagination by putting together various ideas derived from having experienced our own mind, And we conceive of them as perfect, without any inherent limits, and we arrive at the idea of God. Yeah?
It seems to be like the polar reverse of that proof of Aquinas, where you imagine the maximum and any good or truth or beauty, and God is the maximum of those qualities. And he was saying, you can't do that. That's false. Or instead of the maximum going backwards, he's saying, you can't go from your impressions of goodness to infinite.
They're almost it's almost an inversion. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, there's something inverted about Hume's argument. It's the negative image, you might say, of what Aquinas is trying to do. Yes. Okay, so now we get to miracles. So that's Hume and his skepticism about God. There might be a God, we just can't know him, but all the evidence seems to be against it. So you might say Hume is agnostic rather than atheist, but Dawkins would probably come back and say, well, Hume would have been an atheist, but it just wasn't socially acceptable enough, so he softened things because he didn't want to tell people how stupid they were. That tends to be Dawkins' move. Anyone who lived back when Christianity was popular would have been an atheist, but they always had to hedge their bets because of the societal pressures of it all. Hume has a number of arguments against the existence of miracles, and it really begins for Hume with the idea that just because an event is rare or unusual or unexplained doesn't make it a miracle. There has to be something more. And for Hume, the definition really is this. A miracle is the direct intervention of a deity in violation of the laws of nature. So direct intervention, violation of the laws of nature. And Hume's going to say there's a problem with both of those parts. In order for an extraordinary event to be a miracle, we therefore have to show it was done by means of the direct activity of God. But how can we show God's direct activity if we don't even have a clear idea of who God is? You see how Hume's building his own case step by step. And as for the violation of the laws of nature, well, actually, Hume also believes that laws of nature aren't really objective as such. In other words, we talk about laws of nature, but what we're really talking about is a kind of regularity to our experience. So, yes, the sun always rises, but that's just based on past experience. I don't actually have evidence. Well, now we do. But, you know, back in the day, in the absence of better astronomical information, all we could do was say, well, yes, the sun has always risen, and we expect it to rise tomorrow. But this does not result in an actual law of nature. There's just a kind of regularity of events. So if we have just mere regularity, how do I know that something that is outside that regularity isn't just something that's unusual or rare, but actually a violation of the laws of nature? According to Hume, we don't. Moreover, for Hume, in judging the truth of any matter of fact, we inevitably weigh the believability of what is supposed to have happened with the credibility of a witness, right? So the more unbelievable the thing that's been reported, the more we rely on our witness's truthfulness and reliability, right? And if it's really truly unbelievable, but our witness tends to be a fibber, then we're likely to say, I don't think that happened, right? That makes sense, right? If it's something truly outrageous, man, we want to have a really reliable witness. Now, if miracles are that incredible, then there really is no testimony that is so firm and trustworthy so as to be sufficient to establish the truth of that unbelievable event. In other words, if we're encountering a situation that is miraculous, there's no possible witness that is going to be reliable enough for me to believe that. Sorry, say again? He doesn't address that necessarily. Additional witnesses would help. But I think, again, for Hume, there's really no number of witnesses that would... In other words, collusion would always be a better explanation for, you know, the miracle actually having occurred. Now, notice that if we make up our mind about miracles and say that they are completely improbable, then we're going to naturally arrive at Hume's conclusion. That is, if we've already stacked the deck and said, miracles are impossible, right? Something so extraordinary is really not possible at all. Then I've basically ruled them out in advance, and no amount of testimony is going to be able to change my mind. This is essentially the hole that Hume digs for us. So very clever arguments. If they don't completely convince you, that's okay, because they didn't completely convince everyone in Hume's day either. This was not, in fact, Hume was very slow to publish this portion of his thought. He waited till close to the end of his life because it was very unpopular.
All right, Masters of Suspicion, we have 10 minutes. Are there, do we have questions? I know we've been taking questions in and out, but maybe, or do we just want to launch into the, go for it, go, okay.
Okay.
Oh, wait, one, we'll, okay, safe. So we're going to start with Marx. So rest of the time is on Marx, Freud, and good old Friedrich. All of them focus on motives for believing in God and uses of purposes that religious beliefs can be put service to. They virtually never argue directly for or against religious belief or God's non-existence, but their focus is to foster suspicion of religion by focusing on the psychological, economic, political, and personal motives for belief, and were dubbed by Ricoeur as masters of suspicion. So they're not going to be marshaling arguments, philosophical arguments against the existence of God, but they're going to be looking at these different areas of political, economic, psychological, and even moral links, and said, wouldn't it be better if we could free ourselves from an idea of God? We could achieve a kind of thriving and happiness in these different areas of belief. So, Marx, a well-known father of communism, socialism, an avowed atheist. He was an advocate for the working class, the proletariat, and concerned to expound a theory of history and an alternative economic theory, and to describe alternative possibilities for human existence. He's not really interested in arguing for atheism as such, or showing that God doesn't exist. So, you know, in his Communist Manifesto, it's not an argument for the non-existence of God. His Das Kapital is not an invective against that. But he sees that economic realities have impact all aspects of human existence, and the effects of the struggle to make a living and acquire means for survival and the possession of private property tends to solidify into a definite class structure, and he's going to argue against class structure, and he's going to say religion causes class structure as well. So he's going to want to break down these structures. So oftentimes, this is the means that Marx is particularly one-sided. Everything seems to be a function of economics, and spiritual reality seem but a kind of effect or symptom of what's really happening with us materially. So once again, if you go to the eye doctor, right, he's going to know all about your eye, right, and describe perhaps everything in those terms. Or as the old saying goes, to the hammer, everything is a nail, right? To Marx, everything, it's all about the money. For Marx, in this sense, in terms of, and not just like, but economy, right? So everything is seen, so religion is going to have a kind of means or motive that in the end is going to be explained in economic kinds of terms. He's also sensitive in the ways in which ideas and ideology can function as justifications and rationalizations for current economic conditions, and they usually do in subtle, self-effacing ways. They claim to be about something altogether so that their function is propping up the status quo that's hidden. And here's where we're going to agree with Marx too, right? Remember, we're going to say perhaps where he's, well, what he says, perhaps why it's not on the mark, but then also his critique has some justification to it.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of truth in Marx. So we can comfortably agree with Marx, for instance, that, gosh, if we are consumed with our capitalist concerns, our values are going to tend to shrink and become a function of our capitalism. I think that that's a pretty legitimate critique, and that we will often use certain ideas to justify what we would like to do anyway economically. So an economic system tends to have a kind of self-perpetuating effect on those who are in it simply by materially giving rise to a certain set of ideas that buy into that particular economic system.
Thinking in terms of the world in which Marx lived and the conditions in
was huge economic inequalities going on, and he was passionate about that. And I think that he was driven by that more than an attempt to disavow the existence of God. That was really not on his plate. But it was on his plate was the immediate economic situation which was right in front of his face, I think.
I would not be tempted to characterize this as an either-or situation. In other words, Marx could very easily have critiqued prevailing economic conditions without having much comment on God or even affirming the existence of God, as in, for instance, the social teaching of the Catholic Church. Or we might even look at, say, Charles Dickens, who is about his time. Charles Dickens has a lot to say about the social situation in industrialized Britain. Hard Times is a really great invective against what's happening. And yet you don't have a militant atheism as part of that formula. So I don't think it's an either or. But I think you're right in emphasizing that atheism is not the sole concern of Marx, but it is there. And we have to take it seriously.
I didn't get that. You know, maybe that was a time of my life in the way I looked at the book and his philosophy, but I didn't think in terms of, so kind of agree with it. I didn't think in terms of whether or not this is either or, God exists or God doesn't exist. I was thinking in terms of what he's actually saying about the economic world. That was impressive. I had some real problems with his conclusions.
Yeah, although that's in it too. And we have to remember that Marx is not just a social critic. He is putting together a full-blown philosophy that he inherits and modifies from Hegel. So he's a full-fledged thinker, very complex, and he functions on a lot of different dimensions. So just because there is, I think, maybe a positive appreciation of his critical function doesn't mean that we can't say that there are other ingredients in his philosophy that we can disagree with. So, yes, I think fundamentally we agree.
Yeah. I would think one of his very famous statements is that religion is the opiate of the masses, right? So he sees religion as a kind of sedative or painkiller, if you will, that keeps people from rising up and changing the system. So he sees religion as an impediment to this kind of social upheaval that he wants. Religion tends to be just even socioeconomically, keeps in his mind people in their different classes and structures. And in this way, religion makes the misery of the lower classes more tolerable, because obviously if part of your religion is stressing the afterlife, right, it can tend to relativize this life in extremes. Not that, once again, Church has a very strong and even at this time social teaching. Whether that's lived or not is a good question, but there are ways to articulate that and have been articulated. But his viewpoint into that, to see religion as a competing effect, and if we could just break those tethers, if we could just like get off the drug of religion, then there would be this kind of rising up of the masses to overthrow this unjust system. And so
forces social stratification. I mean, Christianity is always saying be good to the poor. You know, looks. I mean, I'll have so many gospel stories that put a wealthy person below.
Yeah. No. So those aren't gonna. Those. That's right to critique.
Great point.
Yeah, those are going to be hard for him to answer.
No, okay, it's a selective reading of Christianity for sure, because you definitely could make the case that there's another side. Yes.
Yeah, his go-to passages are going to be passages where, like St. Paul says, to be, happy whatever you're doing, right? If you're free, you're free. If you're a slave, you're a slave. If you're married, you're married. So to look at that, Jesus didn't necessarily come to form a kingdom of this world, and so he would cherry picks different passages like that. But the question certainly of the gospel as being having certainly social justice. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's not his strong. He's not quoting those things, right? He's not quoting those things.
And but he would point to things like how. In many states there has been a bit of a collusion between official religion as it's functioned, and the state. That is, you know, official religion basically says, no, no, we have to be good citizens. This is part of the Christian morality. I think he has those kinds of things in mind. Again, I think you're right to see that it's a selective reading, and there's obviously data that's not getting in there.
And as long as we're pointing out similarities, there are some who look at the Acts of the Apostles, and in the Acts it says, the company of those who believed were one heart and one soul, and no one said that any of the things they possessed was his own, but they had everything in common. Therefore, the early Christians were communists, right? No, absolutely not, right? So in the same way there, not at all. There's certainly a lot more to Marxism than common property. In fact, it's not. It's collectivized property. And communism wasn't to a kind of militant atheism, materialism, determinism, and elimination of the social structures, including the church and other organizations and family outside of the government. So once again, there can be these kind of like similarities, but by no means is that...
Well, the point that Marxism has a dynamism of history, which is the dialectic,
yep.
which is not Christian.
Well, we're going to actually make the opposite.
You're talking to Mr. Dialectic here.
Well, what I mean is the driving thing is the thesis and antithesis, whose synthesis. But then you keep doing that, but at the head of history is the theory of the proletariat, and then that becomes.
So why don't you let us present on that, and we'll hopefully address your concern in that.
All right, I jumped forward. Sorry. Okay, so here's and we'll do two more slides. I know we're out of time, and this is but one thing we can agree with Marx is that the church has a very clear teaching, and this was John Paul II. Talking about structures of sin. There's certainly ways in which we personally fail, but when that happens and we do that as a community, and that's enshrined in principles of organization, the Pope says that if the present situation can be attributed to difficulties of various kinds, it is not out of place to speak of structures of sin that are rooted in personal sin and are always linked to concrete acts of individuals who introduce these structures, consolidate them, and make them difficult to remove, and thus they grow stronger and spread and become the source of other sins. So cultures, organizations, even the church itself, can foster these structures of sin. And certainly just in terms of our own culture, Time's Up, Me Too, things like that, point to those kinds of structures that we need to fight against. We just don't, our faith doesn't tell us just to kind of sit back, even though certainly our time on earth has a kind of relativity to it. We're meant for eternal life. That doesn't mean we're indifferent towards it, right? And so that's
it can be harder to spot, though. And this is one of the things that Marx is good about pointing out, is that when it's institutionalized sin, sometimes the sinful character gets ignored. Unless it's directly affecting you or you've had an experience where it really comes to the fore, sometimes it's just something we've taken for granted. We've just always done it that way. So sometimes these social movements take us by surprise, but are so powerful because they point out what was before us, and it's shocking, but really helpful.
And the last thing perhaps to say about Marx, at least at this point, is that his idea, and Shelley, you mentioned this, the kind of dialectical materialism and this idea of the workers' paradise, right? So the kind of goal of everything only makes sense, and this Nietzsche might point this out to him, in a Christian worldview, right? If he was not already, in other words, you already have the idea that's presented of a kind of heaven, right? And so he takes a kind of secularized Christian eschatology, that is just the end of all things, the culmination of all things. And so he takes a Christian vision of heaven and kind of waters it down, relativizes it to earth, talks about the proletariat accomplishing for itself by collective action what is only possible in eternal life by violent overthrow of capitalism and individual values. And so, and this is what Nietzsche will point out, that he doesn't quite go far enough. In other words, his theory is already influenced by Christian values and a Christian way of looking at things. And so, as we'll see, Friedrich goes all the way in terms of beyond.
Yeah, in many ways, Nietzsche is the more radical. But eschatology, of course, is just the study of the last things. And in many ways, you can look at Marx and say, what he's just done is he's brought heaven to earth, right? It's not a paradise, a heavenly paradise. It's a worker's paradise. And God doesn't do it for us. We do it for ourselves. But there is definitely a trajectory for history, and this is what Shelley was getting at, and he's absolutely right. There's a definite trajectory for history. History will inevitably, according to Marxism, end up with the overflow of the overthrow of all of the classes and the triumph of the proletariat in a kind of workers' paradise. So no matter what we do, this is going to happen, and it's going to happen with a certain degree of collective action and overthrow. So we're going to do it for ourselves, provided that we're part of the proletariat. If you're not part of the proletariat, then that's sad for you. but notice that there is a definite end to history, and it results in a kind of paradise. This, we could say, has a kind of Christian inspiration, even if it's been secularized and in some ways emptied of a lot of its properly Christian content. Someone like Nietzsche will come and say, this is only Christianity warmed over.
The ultimate synthesis was, as the gentleman was saying, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. His ultimate synthesis was the conclusion of a work of paradise. But I never thought of it in terms of it's really a Christian ideal.
That's right. Yeah, it's just a better. Well, one last one before we run. Yeah.
You had this slide there a couple of sessions ago. Yep. About the early Christians.
Yep.
Yep. So the early Christians and communists, actually the early Christians, using that analogy, were more like the Catholic worker movement.
Yes, exactly.
Dorothy Day, yes. Exactly. Oh my gosh, I love it. That's so true.
Exactly.
And again, one of our hints is the difference between common property and collectivized property. Because in the socialist system, even in the Marxist version, but let's take the Soviet Union as, you know, perhaps one form of this, was there common property? No, because common property was supposed to be everybody's. What you had was collectivized property, which was nobody's. It was the state, right? And what ended up happening, of course, is that that meant that there were certain people who really got, you know, an awfully big portion of the cake, and everyone else was subsistent farmer. So, you know, when we're talking about collectivized agricultural property, for instance. So, yeah, I absolutely agree. Is, you know, the ideal of common property, I think we read that into Marxism. And I think maybe there is something like that desire in Marx. But what you really get is collectivization, not commonality.
If you're wondering about God and the unconscious, that's next time. Thank you, everyone.